This is episode 22 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake.
And when you finally speak for the first time in, a year? You shout Jill's name to your husband, the same guy these people made you divorce. And he goes running in. I mean, she's in there because of you. But you can't save her. He's the one to save her because all you can do is stand there and watch. And I know all of this, Lori, because you put it in your book. But what I don't know, Lori, and what I need to know is how you feel about it.
From Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to the leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's talk about Off-Ramp. Suddenly I'm hidden. It is the darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. And your friends won't come. So show me where you fit. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name's Blake, and I don't break for the GR either. Can you imagine just running people over because, I feel like it. Why not?
No.
No. What are you doing, Lori? We're just running people over because, what, you want to test it out to see if they'll move? Do you want to make them feel bad about themselves? Where are we going with this?
That's, I think that and many more reasons are why Lori is acting a little cray-cray.
And I'm laughing a little bit because we've tried to record this episode now maybe five, six times.
Yes.
And it's just been a comedy of errors.
Yeah.
Between me screwing something up or Mary screwing something up or our Felicity, who is sitting right next to us right now, so you may hear her babble.
You're going to hear her a lot. I'm just warning you. She's had a cold, so she is like fighting nap. And we were like, we don't care. We don't care that our baby wants to talk because we need to record this episode.
I know. And Mary wasn't feeling well. Neither were the kids the day that we normally record. So this is obviously postponed, so thank you for being patient with us. But yeah, so you may hear our daughter babble here and there. My love, what's your what are the Damon ratings that we have so far?
The Damon ratings we have, you mean from our friends?
Yeah. Why don't we talk about what our guests have?
Okay. George Whitaker gives it 5 Damons. I'm all in. This show is beginning to look like a masterpiece. Love the twists and turns. Jake Waldron says, I would give this episode 108 Damons. Look at you, Jake.
You have to go back, Kate.
Look at you being so losty.
Clint Church says, 4 Damons. Never been as intrigued with Tom's storyline compared to the Garvey Durst. But this episode is helping change that. And for you, my darling, what is your Damon rating?
I'd give it a solid 4. I'd give it a solid 4. Pretty much for the same reason. I like Tom and I like Lori and I loved how weird this episode was. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to lie. There was no Patty. And I think Patty pushes it over the edge for me. Like, there was a little Patty. There was a little Patty in the flashback.
Yep, okay.
But, and I like that Lori is really losing her stuff. I really liked this episode. Yeah, I'm giving it a 4, leaning a high 4. You know, it could be 4.5 Damons.
Oh, look at you.
Yeah.
You know, if I was originally thinking this was going to be a 3.5 Damon episode for me, but the more that I came away from it, the more that I got a chance to look back on it, I'm giving it a 4 Damon episode. So I think we're all kind of in agreement here. And what I liked about it was that it kind of called back to season 1 in a lot of different ways. And that's a good thing and a bad thing. Because I love season 1. The problem that we have is that now we're in season 2.
We're in Miracle.
And Miracle to me is so freaking interesting.
Yes.
And what's happening to Kevin is so, it's just compelling. And what's happening with the Murphy is also compelling. So to take a step back from that and go back to Mapleton, even though this is being filmed in Texas, but to go back to Mapleton, it almost feels like, again, I said this before, a step back.
But Just think about it. I think that these three episodes are all the first episode. They have to do this. They can't be like doing all three of these at the same time. You needed to be, you know, in the Murphy's shoes. You needed to be in Kevin's shoes. Mm-hmm. And now you need to be in Lori's shoes. And there's no way that they could have done all of this in the same episode and had the same feeling.
Correct. I agree. Well, what did we forget?
All right. So there were conversations between Jill and Kevin where she brought up the house that she feels safe.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The one where Kevin had freaked out, obviously, in the last episode after the light bulb exploded and they went back into the house after seeing the Murphys.
Yeah.
And
she basically said, stop effing up.
Yeah, stop screwing this up. And one of the reasonings behind it, and we talked about this a little bit, but I wanted to really highlight it, is Jill said something so freaking wise for her age, which is Nora bought the house because it made her feel safe, right? Mm-hmm. It made her feel like life is okay. And it goes back to that initial line when they kept saying, it's okay. It's okay.
Maybe not that life is okay, but it won't happen here. You know, Nora thinks it's about now where you're located. Mm-hmm. Her family disappeared because they were located at that table and nobody disappeared at Miracle. Mm-hmm. So she sees Miracle as a safe place.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And she wants to be there no matter what. And that, in the end, is what makes Kevin go, oh, derp. that's what this is all about. And that's when he says, I'm an asshole. And that is a total guy thing to do when you just realize, I am such a freaking idiot. I was not looking at it from that perspective. Trust me, it happens to me all the time. So the second one is the Christmas lights guy.
Yay!
Christmas lights guy actually has a name.
Oh.
And it's Virgil.
Hi. Did not know your name, sir.
I think we still should call him Christmas lights guy.
I think that's great because he's probably friends with Dirty Santa.
So, well, they both like Christmas, so why not?
It's but beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Yes, I'm not going to sing. The thing about Virgil is that it's a very unique name. And the first thing I thought about when I heard the name Virgil is the Roman poet Virgil. Oh,
yes, that is the first thing I thought of too.
No, well, it's the...
Excuse me while I...
Sorry, I told you.
...stroke my books and have a cigar.
I went to fancy schools where we had palatial estates.
And I had bed lifters.
Bed lifters. See, I majored in history, so that's why I know this stuff. And Virgil is a Roman poet, and Virgil, and just to get a good write-off about this, I went to Wikipedia just so I can explain it a little bit
yes,
further.
Yes, so trusted. I'm glad your expensive education taught you to
go to Wikipedia. Virgil is traditionally ranked as one of Rome's greatest poets. His Aeneid has been considered the national epic of ancient Rome from the time of its composition to the present day. Modeled after Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, the Aeneid follows the Trojan refugee's Aeneas as he struggles to fulfill his destiny and arrive on the shores of Italy in Roman mythology, which was the founding act of Rome. So, you know the whole story about the Trojan horse?
Yes, I actually know that one.
Okay, so Troy. Remember the movie Troy? Brad Pitt? He was like all jacked and he was fighting all the Greeks?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes, I
so
do.
So after Troy falls, right? The king of Troy, the prince of Troy, they all die. But they take the sword of Troy and they give it to this guy, Aeneas, who is a Trojan. And Aeneas takes all of his people that he could get onto a boat and he goes to Rome. And Aeneas technically finds Rome and helps create Rome, the Roman Empire that we all know. So Virgil's work has been wide and deep influence on Western literature, and most notably Dante's Divine Comedy, in which Virgil, the author, appears as Dante's guide through hell and purgatory.
How am I supposed to know any of this, Damon Lindelof?
I'm just saying, well, that's why you got us. That's why you have the Living Reminders podcast, because we talk about this stuff for you. So
take it deep.
What I'm getting at is this. Virgil is going to have a big role in this show. And maybe somehow he's going to help people and guide people through the problems that they're having, just like Virgil does in Dante's Inferno and just like Aeneas does in the Aeneid. He helps find someplace new.
Except in Dante's, he is guiding them through hell. in purgatory.
But maybe it's hell and purgatory that they're actually in. Maybe Miracle is not a good place. Maybe Miracle is really a bad place. And I think we're starting to see the very beginnings of that.
Let's play Figure Out That Title.
Well, my love, what do you got?
Okay, so I'm going really deep. Off-Ramp, of course, is the title. There were a lot of cars in this episode. Okay, I know. Well, okay, Off-Ramp A, we're kind of like off the ramp of Miracle, Texas. We're not where we normally are. We're back in Mapleton. We're not where we're supposed to be right now. Great where are one. We? Why are we taking a detour to stop? Okay, what's going on? What's going on? But there were just so many cars. Like, I loved it. The episode opens up to Lori washing her car. By the way, as soon as I saw that it was Lori, I was like, she hit people. I knew it right away. Right away. And they kept showing it. And I was like, she hit more people because now she's wearing a different outfit. Oh, she's wearing a different outfit again. Girlfriend's hitting lots of people. So I was really excited about that. But then also, we had the woman who killed her and her family driving in that car. Mm-hmm. So lots of car stuff. And I took it as we are off ramp or off the Miracle Highway because we need to go catch up on some other stuff.
Wow. Drop the freaking mic.
It's time to reheat the leftovers.
All right, kiddo.
As I said, starts off with Lori washing her car. I knew right away. You want to know why I knew right away? I saw that and I said, someone hit somebody. Somebody killed somebody because Blake's uncle, right? You know, Blake's family rides motorcycles and his uncle once told me this story about how he accidentally hit a wild turkey and there were like blood and guts and everything was all over his motorcycle and he had to go wash it off at a car place. And I saw this person washing their car, focusing on the hood and the front of the car. And I was like, somebody just hit a person. That's what it is. You're washing some blood. That's what it has to be. So, you know, we see Lori doing this multiple times and obsessing. We even saw that little spot where she saw that fleck. And at first I didn't know what that was. But then the more I thought about it, I was like, oh, that was a fleck of blood on her windshield. Not just her being crazy, but...
I can't believe you remember that story, number one.
It's pretty hard to forget that your uncle-in-law murdered a turkey accidentally with his motorcycle.
It was a wild turkey.
I know. It was accident. It was accident. It's like when people accidentally hit deer. I'm just happy that he's okay, but I'll never get the image. He was very descriptive. It was like one of those conversations by a campfire. It's very descriptive about turkey guts.
The one thing that really grabbed me about this entire opening scene was the drums.
I was going to call it Miles Teller and Whiplash.
The Whiplash drums. And the going back and forth between normal life afterwards of exchanging money, the consumerism, buying things, opening things, coffees and lattes, and then totally counteracted by the complete silence of the GR. So it's descriptive of a couple of things. It's descriptive of the consumerism of the world, in my opinion, but it's also showing you the hectic life that Lori is trying to get back involved with. But she can't help but still have this little bit of the guilty remnant in her.
I like to call it a little bit of the crazy. It was so loud and so fast that it actually reminded me of the music that Kevin listens to drown out his craziness. So I was taking that as Lori's trying to act like she's got her shit together.
But
she's popping that Nicorette gum. She's got her friends coming in for the coffee. She's doing her hair. Hair looks great, by the way. But she's still got the crazy.
Oh, totally. She's totally got crazy. And we see that later on in the episode when she's choking the publisher out because as we played in our first clip of the show, that the guy is asking her how she feels. And I think ultimately what she did is how she really feels.
Yes.
And she's called out for her anger so often in this show. And she keeps saying, I'm not angry. I'm fine. But we all know that the crazy's there. And, you know, like even, hey, come on, lady, you're hitting people. You're hitting people left and right.
And it's amazing that she says, you know, when she breaks down about that, that they don't move out of the way. Why do you think she hits people?
You know, I don't know. I don't know off the top of my head. I will say, I wonder if it's because she's trying to figure out if the guilty remnant are really real. Like, if they're, like, not real, like, oh, they're standing there real, but they're real, like, they're gonna do what they actually say they will do. Because remember, she's dealing with people that she's trying to advise and counsel who are questioning the GR, and she brings them in and she tries to save them from them. Does every one of these people feel like that? Does every one of these people feel like how she did after the houses burned down over in Mapleton? So now she's going to test it. Because not everybody is going to be Patty. Not everybody is going to be Meg, right?
Yeah.
So let's see what they got.
I'm not going to lie. I'm fast forwarding quite far into the episode when she runs into the house, breaks into the house, takes the laptop. And I'm sitting there watching this and it has, you know, the music going and it's like loud, fast. She grabs it. She gets into her car. She puts on that really cool music and she's like feeling it. And I was smiling that entire time because I'm like, that's what I would do. I would be like, you stole my, Blake knows this. You stole my laptop. I'm going to find my iPhone app that and go into your house, steal it from your kid, go into my car and blast music and like rock out my car. And so I was nodding my head, smiling with Lori. And I'm like, yeah, girl, I'd do the same thing. I got you back. I got, wait, no, don't hit those people. Lori, I wouldn't do that, Lori. I would not have hit them. That you went too far. So yeah, I'm down with some of her crazy. I'm down with it, you know? Someone treats you wrong and you don't know what's going on in this world. But
I'd like to follow that up too, because it was, that scene was tense, man. That scene was so freaking tense when she's just walking around in that house. And you know, you've seen that a billion times in shows and the way it's shot, and of course you have the Russian lady come walking up and she's right next to Lori on the other side of the wall, and you know, it's a little cliche, but It was really intense as she's walking up the stairs, but it was great because it was finally, the tension was released when she sees the kid and he's playing a game, and she doesn't say like, oh, hey, little Billy, like that, you know, can I have that computer or nothing? She just walks right up and snatches it right out of the kid's
grab
hands.
And take, grab and take, as Joan Rivers would say.
Grab and take. I can't believe she just grabbed it.
I would have done the same thing. I was in there giving her a high five.
Ran out.
It's mine.
I expected a little bit more finesse from her.
No.
Nope. Not so much. Not
really
so much.
Proud of her. And I'm glad she got it back. And I'm glad she's writing this book. I am so glad that she has written this book. Granted, she probably does need to put a bit more of her heart inside of it. But how freaking cool. And imagine if she gets her shit together, how amazing this book will be and how it will blow the lids off on cults like The Guilty Remnant.
Yeah, so here's the question. Is the book meant to just expose The Guilty Remnant, or is the book meant to take down The Guilty Remnant?
Both in Jill's mind.
Lori's mind.
I mean, yeah, Lori's mind.
Okay.
But I think expose in the publisher's mind. I think the publishers want a beautifully sad, tragic story because they don't feel that. Listen, if you are that sad, you're in The Guilty Remnant, or you've been in it, or you're doing some weird, weird stuff.
Sure.
These publishers were like, oh, hi, look at me in my nice suit. Ha 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 ha. Yep. I want to know more about how sad and how depressing and how disgusting this is. Like, they see it from their ivory tower.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy. Lori wants to ruin these people because of what they led her to do.
Oh, okay. Because ultimately putting her daughter in danger that the way they did, because again, Lori cared about The Guilty Remnant. It's obvious that she did. She was in there for an entire year. But when it came down to her family and her family getting hurt, you're right. I think that did push her over the edge. And that's why she tests people. She tests them to see if they'll get out of the way, if they'll actually stay true to what they're being taught, the rhetoric that they're being taught by The Guilty Remnant, right?
You know, it's starting to get a little scary, though. I mean, well, not a little scary. Let's be honest. The Guilty Remnant has been scary for a long time. But what they're doing now with Tom makes me wonder if there's more people like Tom who are fakes, or if really word. Because remember how Tom said they're not communicating? They had to have been communicating because that girl had a whistle and they knew to go after him.
Correct.
So the Guilty Remnant, for some reason, maybe it's because we were in Miracle, I kind of forgot about them. And Patty died, and I just thought the Guilty Remnant's going to disband. They burned in the fire, or they were sad. Yes, we didn't know what happened to Meg. Mm-hmm. But I just kind of wrote the Guilty Remnant off. And this is showing us that they're not written off. They're actually picking up steam and they're getting stronger.
Sure, they're all over the place, right? They're continuing to get more people involved in their program. And I have a really cool sudden theory about this, actually, that I'm going to leave toward for the end of the episode. Here's another thing. So Lori puts Jill in danger by giving her the opportunity to be in the Guilty Remnant last season. Spoiler alert. Now we have Lori again back doing the same exact thing, but in the opposite direction.
To Tom.
And what does that say about Lori?
Lori's not a good mom. That's what that says.
Oh, hell no.
Hi, let's take my mentally unstable son who just went through a pretty traumatic year and let's put him in really mentally and emotionally compromising situations repeatedly.
Yeah, and not only was it mentally challenging for him, but you know the poor kid's out there drinking left and right. I mean, you see that in the opening scene with the two of them when he's sleeping. I mean, the kid's pounding Jack Daniels like it's his job. So you see him in this light, like he definitely has an issue, and you have no problem sending this kid into the fire. I mean, what are we even doing here, Lori, right? So it just shows you what she will do to accomplish anything in her means. She's going to take
selfish.
The laptop. Oh, she's very selfish. She's going to take the laptop. She is going to hit the GR people. She's going to put Jill in danger. She's going to write the book at all cost. She is going to put Tom in danger. She just wants to do what she wants to do. And you want to root for her as a good guy or as a good character in this episode. And the same thing for Tom. You want to root for them, but there's too much gray there.
You want to root for them because they think what they're doing is right. They and we love these characters, and they think that they're the good guys.
Yeah, but so do the GR.
Exactly.
So who is right and who is wrong? That's the question. And can you ever really be who you really want to be and who you really are after the departure?
Well, I was just thinking about how incredibly different she is from Nora, because I think Nora is being who she is.
In what way? What do you mean?
I mean, post Holy Wayne hug, Nora's open and she's open about her craziness and she's open about what she wants and she's loving and she's not selfish.
Ah, okay. Great connection there because, yeah, you're right. Because you see Nora opening up to Kevin saying, this is going to be our relationship. We're not going to separate. We are not. That's just the way that it is. That's something that we didn't mention last episode, too. They were confident that their relationship was going to last. She is going to stick by him, hopefully, throughout the duration. Yet, we have Lori, on the other hand, going into the Guilty Remnant this entire time, then leaving, and then saying, I'm not angry. I'm totally fine, by the way. Everything is cool. Everything is awesome. And not only is everything so awesome for me, but I'm going to help other people and have them leave the Guilty Remnant. So it just seems a little bit, yeah, you're right. I think Lori is the opposite character to Nora. Yeah. And ultimately, I'm happier that Nora is with Kevin than Lori is with Kevin.
And look at the relationship that Jill now has with Nora.
Correct. It's that mother. It's really a fun mother-daughter relationship. And Jill is shunning, in fact, Lori in a lot of different ways because she gets the note in episode two. And it was heartbreaking to see Lori say, hey, can you let me drive you to the meeting that you're having with Jill? Can you just let me be there? It's like, I'm not even going to be there. I want to write her a note. Can you give it to her? And she does care about Jill. And you can't say that she's so selfish that she doesn't care about Jill, that she doesn't care about her family. Obviously, she does. But what she doesn't need and what she doesn't have is this connection that Nora has with Jill. Great stuff.
What do you think about that therapy group that Lori leads?
I think it's ultimately a good thing. I do wonder how much use it is for them at all, or how much use it is to the overall scheme that Tom and Lori are doing. Like when Tom says, this isn't working, the whole program isn't working. You know, I see where he's coming from because what they're doing is they're just taking a few people out here and there. And no matter what, the Guilty Remnant are growing. And they're continuing to grow. And yes, you may take one person out, and you may help them, but two more will pop up. Two more will go in. Three more will go in for every one person you take out.
So in that scene when the Guilty Remnant actually broke in to the therapy session, my heart sank.
Oh my God, it sank for me too. It sank for me because you don't know what they're going to do. You don't know if they're going to get physical, if they're going to go and beat the hell out of people. You don't know what they're going to say, and they write on the note. And here's another thing. You have these people now, and you don't know what they're about. But then you see later on Meg in this unbelievable reveal. Like a totally like fantastic reveal of the doors opening in the van, and everything is surrounded in white. You're almost blinded by it. It's almost like she is a godlike figure. You're like, you know how when God shows up in the Bible, it's a blinding light sometimes?
Mm-hmm.
It that was the same exact thing. And it makes you wonder how the show views Meg, or how the Guilty Remnant views Meg now.
Meg is the new sexy hot Patty.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And by the way, hashtag can't ugly uplive Tyler.
Oh, do you like that she had a pretty white outfit?
Yes, I do.
I did not. I was like, seriously? Seriously? Everyone else has to wear pants. Why don't you have to wear pants?
It almost reminded me of Dogma. Remember the movie Dogma?
Yes.
And how, what's her name, what's her bucket there? Alanis Morissette played God, and she had the beautiful white hair and the beautiful dark hair with the white dress. Mm-hmm. Same exact thing.
Well, let's talk about this scene. So actually, before Blake and I had recorded, he was like, wow, that Liv Tyler scene. And I said, do you realize what that was?
Yeah.
That was rape. And it's so hard. It's so hard for our society, I think, to understand men being raped by women.
Oh yeah, no, there's a huge I think there's a huge divide or a huge gap there.
And men being raped by Meg, like by Liv Tyler, by this gorgeous woman.
Sure.
And the way I explained it, I said, Blake, it'd be like me being raped by Nick Lachey, who I think is very attractive.
No, he's not. He's so ugly.
I love him. Anybody
in 98 degrees needs to go away.
I heard a great story that he's a very nice guy, actually. But
oh my
nonetheless,
God, please.
No, it doesn't matter. Rape is rape. And mm-hmm. I'm glad that they showed that this season and not last season, because last season there was a lot of rape on television between Game of Thrones and Outlander, and I think it would have been muddled. And I'm still wondering if it's muddled, because Outlander was male on male rape, Game of Thrones had a lot of females being raped by men. Mm-hmm. This is a woman raping a man. Mm-hmm. And it's Liv Tyler, so she's pretty, and it's just hard. I think it's going to be hard for a lot of people to actually understand what that was.
Well, this opens up a much larger conversation, right? The idea of rape in television. It's now being used in a lot of different ways, and on a lot of different levels. Like you've already talked about, Mary and I have another podcast about this show called Outlander on Stars. It's called Outlander Cast, as a matter of fact. And in the show, spoiler alert, there is a male-on-male rape scene. And it's pretty freaking graphic. And it was handled in a way that it was, you almost had to turn your eyes away. But then you have Game of Thrones. Now, Game of Thrones is famous for all its sexual activity, for all of its nudity. And fine, no problem. I get it. That's not an issue. But now they're becoming infamous for how they've treated rape, because you have the scene with Sansa and what's his name there? I forget the kid's name, the Roose Bolton's kid. And then you had the rape scene between Jaime and Cersei. You had all these things, and they're becoming, it's almost insensitive in the way that they have done it. But now you have this scene in The Leftovers where Meg rapes Tommy. And as you're watching it, it's, you don't know why she's doing it. It's almost to just exert her power over him.
Yeah, and it's not the typical, like, what we think of as rape, where people are saying, no, no, no. Like, it's this gorgeous girl and this guy, and they aren't saying anything, really. I mean, he was saying, you know, what are you doing? Hey, no, wait. And
there's almost some confusion, too, because is he actually starting to get into it, too, a little bit? Like, you could see that, obviously... he was having a response.
But that's why I'm saying it's different. It's really hard. People have a hard time about male rape because men's organs are a little bit more easy to fool than women's organs, pleasure sensors, whatever, penis. Okay. It's a lot easier
to steptoe around that.
No, it's a lot easier to fool a penis into saying, hey, I know you don't want this, but guess what? It's going to happen anyway.
Yep.
And here's a hot girl, and she's all up on you.
Mm-hmm.
And I dare you. I dare you to think about something else.
Sure.
You know? So that's why when it has been portrayed on screen and when it happens in real life, it's hard for people to understand that because they're like, oh, well, then why did you get hard?
Yeah.
If you didn't want it, why did you get hard?
Because you almost can't help it.
That's what I'm getting to. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting at. So Tommy didn't enjoy that. Tommy didn't say, wow, this is great. No, he got raped.
Damon Lindelof actually commented on this entire scene, and bear with me as I read some of this. He said, I wouldn't say that we handled it with pause as much as we did with sensitivity. Mm-hmm. I think that we knew exactly what we were getting into, and I think that the specific gender politics of that scene would be vastly different if Meg were a man and Tom were a woman.
Yep.
And it would have to be handled with another degree of sensitivity. But ultimately, and I don't want to peel back the onion and say that these are all the conversations that I had in order to make the scene happen, all I can say is that the scene is the beginning of something. It's the beginning of a relationship between those two characters. So there's a larger context to what's happening there. And the pause that we had was really based on, let's not let this be a one-off. Let's treat this with real intention and not just say that this is a scene where one character sexually takes advantage of another character. Let's complicate it. Let's talk about where Tom is in his journey and what it is he is looking for and why he's gravitated towards the guilty remnant and Meg and is now a representative of the guilty remnant and what's happened to her since we saw her last. What was Meg's relationship with Lori and almost like mother and daughter? So they're oddly kind of siblings in a way without even knowing that emotionally. And Meg is really mad at Lori and now she's taking it out on Tom. So there were all these complicated emotional dynamics that we had to discuss in order to justify the scene. And then we did the scene, right? So how amazing is that? Not only did they think about all this stuff, they knew about the gender politics, they knew about all the things that were going into it, but there's something much more dynamic and layered there than just it's a plain old rape scene. It's there's something there and they're doing it for a reason. It's not Sansa getting raped by the Roose Bolton's kid.
Yeah, it's not just because.
It's not Khal Drogo taking advantage of Daenerys Targaryen. It's there is something brewing here and it's going to get much larger. And it makes you wonder if that was the reason why Tom says to everybody or says to Lori, Mom, they know what they got going on over there. They know that things are, they know something. It makes sense. And that it makes, that to me is a little disconcerting because not only does Tommy have a drinking problem, obviously, and he's obviously very emotionally distraught.
Yeah.
But now he's talking about Meg and how they make sense, right? What confused me about this episode is that he's helping them get rid of everybody. Well, he's helping people get out of the guilty remnant. And he's helping his mother. And he's saying how they're a hive. And she and Lori is the one that is defending them, saying that they're people, Tommy. They're not a hive. They're not robots or whatever the hell she said. Yet at the end of the episode, he's saying they make sense. And what about them makes sense? Why do they make sense to Tommy? Is it because of this scene? Is it because what she did? Do you think she did it to him to just mess with him? Like Lindelof talks about Meg and how she's mad at Lori. How she's really pissed off at him. Oh, pissed off at her. Do you think maybe she did this to Tommy to screw with him and get him on her side in a way? It's almost like that, that disease, what's it called? When you're captured by someone and you fall in love with your captors. Oh, what's that called? It's not Florence Nightingale, because that's the one where the nurse falls in love with the patient. Oh, I forget. Anyway, Stockholm Syndrome, is that what it is?
I don't know.
I forget. Anyway, is that what's happening? Because clearly Meg has become something a lot bigger than what she was, right? She's become something that she's gone beyond Patty in a way that it seems. She's gone beyond. She seems much more vindictive than Patty did. And I wonder if she had planned that out. And God, I mean, my God, when she has that lighter in front of Tommy and it's just there, she's just holding it right in front of him, right? My heart was pounding. I mean, pounding.
I thought Tommy was dying, for real.
I thought he was going to die too. And I wouldn't have been surprised if Meg had done it. It would not have surprised me if Lindelof wrote it in there. And it wouldn't surprise me if Tommy died, because then that puts Lori in a position where she has to go against the guilty remnant now. That would move her story further. Of course, they took it a different direction, and now that they're having Tom say that he's given out these magic hugs, I get that.
Do you think Tom told Lori what Meg did to him?
Oh, that's a good question. Because she does ask him, hey, what the hell happened?
I don't think he told her.
Why do you think that?
Because as bad as a parent as Lori is, I mean, let's be honest, she's not really going to win any awards for being Mom of the Year right now. I think she would have like killed Meg or something.
Oh, yeah. You think she would have drove over there and...
and hit her with a car.
Hit some people with cars again.
Boom. Found you. Would have run in her house, stole her laptop, and then hit her with a car. Yeah, I don't think Lori would be too keen on that.
No,
on her
well,
son
obviously,
being raped,
I don't think that she would, but it's more along the lines of, is Tom trying to prevent her from knowing what happened? Because, again, it goes back to this idea. Yes, Tom was raped, but... and I know he was almost burned to death. I mean, again, like I've said, my heart was pounding during that scene. But did he enjoy it a little bit? Did something happen to him where it just made his brain click? And he doesn't want his mom to know. I mean, do you think that's possible?
I have no idea, but this is a sick show, so I have no idea. <It's>,
like Tom Perotta says... it's the leftovers.
Yeah, yeah. I have no idea what's going on.
By the way, go back and listen to our interview with Tom Perotta at thelivingreminders.com. Shameless plug.
Okay, let's talk about the patient. What was her name? The blonde that came in.
Oh, crap. Oh, this is going to have to be saved for what do we forget next what do we forget for next week?
Yeah.
Because I forget her name now.
Gosh.
Damn it, I feel so unprepared.
So sad. I mean... how could you not want to cry every single time you saw that woman? I wanted to cry right away when I saw her in the Guilty Remnant house. Yep. I wanted to cry when she came into the first therapy session, when the guys came and threatened her, when she went and saw her husband. I mean, every single time.
I cried. I legitimately cried, right? When she shows up to her house.
Yes.
And the son sees her.
Oh my gosh.
And he just runs to go hug her.
Yes.
Which makes it that much more awful. When they're on the off ramp and you just see her slowly turn the wheel,
mm-hmm.
and the guy starts freaking out. Oh my God, it's the wrong lane. No. But what really freaked me out most is when they showed the kid. Because, you know,
the
kid in the car.
Yeah.
You know, because listen, for those of you who are parents, you get it. You hear our daughter right now is beside us and we're doing this podcast with her. And there's literally nothing that you would ever do to protect that person. That person, like you would do anything. And anytime you would put yourself in harm if you had to do it to protect your child. And for this lady to end it all, not only with herself and her husband, because you know what? You've lived your life. You've done your thing. It's awful to take a person's life, but at least you can, you know, they've lived their lives. Mm-hmm. To take a kid's life because you're messed up. I mean, what do you think is going on in her brain that it, like, they were having those conversations earlier in the meeting, like everything that they were talking about was just dumb, like the people that were not in the GR. Sorry, our kid is like freaking out right now. Anytime that one of the members of that therapy group was talking to one of their family members, it was like, man, you're living in someone else's skin. You're just wearing a mask. Everything you're talking about is dumb. Do you think after she got that note, she realized, oh, man, everything here is just, it's just not right.
Yeah.
Right?
It hit me pretty hard because I don't know if I said this on this podcast, but I had pretty severe postpartum depression after I had my son. And I was seeing like dark thoughts, you know, I was in a very dark place. And I'm in a lot of moms groups and I talk to a lot of moms, and a lot of people come up to me because I have been so open about my postpartum depression. I've been very open with people. I've written blog posts about it. I've talked about how dark it was in that time in my life. And so people actually talk to me a lot about their depression and their anxiety.
Check it all out at tallmomtinybaby.com, shapeless plug.
And I've talked to a few people just this same week. And then I saw this, and that's how depressed this woman is that she doesn't even think about her child anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people can get to that dark, deep place. And it's so sad because things like that, you know, you don't hear stories like this all the time about a woman going in the wrong lane and hitting a truck. But things like this can happen, whether it's postpartum depression, whether it's other circumstances in their lives.
Yeah.
So it shows how real. I mean, yes, the departure is something that has never happened and we still don't understand it. But the writers are touching upon such major issues, even just in this episode, you know, male rape by a female, and severe depression where you put yourself and your family in harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
And God, you know, I wasn't thinking thoughts like that, but I know some people that had thoughts about hurting their family or hurting their baby. And
I remember reading an article at one time where a lady was saying she wouldn't take a shower. She wouldn't take a shower because she had such bad postpartum depression that anytime she went into the bathroom and into the shower, turned the water on, she thought that the shower head was talking to her, telling her to kill her family.
Yeah.
So she just wouldn't take showers.
Yeah.
And of course, whatever, you're not taking showers, who cares? You just smell bad. But still, the idea is depression,
your mind,
depression can go, it can take you to places that you don't even understand.
Yeah.
And it's incomprehensible to someone who does not suffer from depression.
Yeah. So for you to say, to see that and to say, you know, I, as a parent, you would do everything in your power to protect your child. Yes. But when your mind and your heart is compromised by severe issues like mental illness,
mm-hmm.
whether it's depression or whatever, you're not able to think like that.
There were two really important artistic choices that were made during this scene when she's talking to her husband. The husband's getting ready. She's getting ready. For the first important artistic choice was when the husband is talking, the wife is getting ready, and she's just putting her clothes on. Everything is out of focus. Every single screen, like inch of that screen, is out of focus. And then when she comes closer and she sees the note and it says any day now, all of a sudden, things become clearer on the picture.
Mm-hmm.
Things become a little bit more focused for her and for the viewer.
What did you take that to mean?
So I took that as, no matter what, like you saw her waking up and she's at dinner and the fish is being deboned.
Oh, hated that shot.
You know what I mean? And things are happening. You could tell that she's losing her own bone. She's losing the meat of herself. She doesn't know what is real and what is not real.
Yeah.
That again, it's that depression. It's the shower talking to you,
mm-hmm.
right? That is just exemplified by the picture being out of focus. Once you get in that depression, everything, becomes out of focus. You can't add. You can't even read properly. You can't even think properly. Never mind doing the mundane things of going out to dinner or in getting a fish or putting your clothes on and getting ready to go out with the family on something, and the husband's talking about some asinine thing that we, I couldn't even remember. He was talking about some guy and how he was doing something. It was unimportant. What was important was that everything was out of focus for this lady.
So what is any day now? Because I took it to be any day now, either you're going to die or another departure is going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing with the GR. It's any day now, this is going to come back. Any day now, life will end just like it did before, right? The second important artistic choice that I found was, it was a subtle one, but when the note is opened up, they went back to the original theme for The Leftovers, like the violin theme,
yes.
The one that's played during the scene when Kevin rescues Jill out of the GR house as it's burning. It's the very beginning violin. It's very quick. I'll even put the song up on the webpage so you guys can hear it. Yes, exactly. But all throughout the episode, when it was either Lori or it was with this lady that we're talking about now or whatever, there was always this theme playing. It was like The Leftovers piano theme, but it was a slightly different take. It wasn't as somber. It wasn't as slow. It wasn't as moody, but it was more of a happy, almost floating kind of theme. It was a quicker version of The Leftovers piano theme. And then and it played throughout the entire episode. But as soon as she opened up that note to see any day now, the real GR Leftovers theme starts to play. And what an amazing choice, because now it brings it back. It brings it back to season one and the hopelessness and the dour nature that not only the show was suffering from, but also that the people in the GR are suffering from. Like Lori says, they think the world ended.
Yeah.
How can you ever go back? And yeah, you can eat your Nicorettes, and you can talk about it all day, every day. But how can you go back once you've realized and you've fully believed the world ended as you knew it?
Ugh, God, this show is so sad. It really is,
and that's why it's great too, because you're not seeing this on a lot of television. I mean, Christ, you're seeing CSI and NCIS and Blacklist and Keeping Up with the Kardashians and all this stuff, and none of it is ever actually tackling anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't ever have an artistic sense of what's going on. But now with this show, at least you do. And in the first season, again, I will fully admit, it is dour as hell. But at least it tried to do something. And this season is building upon that. And it may not be as dour, but it's still very much the same show. And I will go to my grave saying this. Anybody who declared this a reboot of this show is so freaking wrong that they should be embarrassed. They should be embarrassed by what they said, simply because of what you saw on the last episode. It's mind blowing how that's happened.
Another major thing we need to talk about. So Tom telling the truth to Lori about what happened between him and Meg didn't most likely happen.
Yep.
Now Tom at the end says that he actually hugged Holy Wayne.
Okay.
And he's got hugging powers.
Do you believe this?
It's like Care Bear hug or something.
Care Bear.
So the thing is that if you remember to season one, we don't know what happened. We saw Tom when he found the baby, and the next thing we knew is that the baby was left on, you know, the Garvey's doorstep. So we don't know what happened in between. Did Holy Wayne show up and do this with Tommy? And did he give him a hug? And does Tommy now have these powers? Or did Tommy and Lori decide, we're going to make this story up to give these people hope?
I'm going to answer that question with a question. What do you think?
I don't know.
All right. I'll give you my answer then. And maybe we can riff on this. How's this sound? part of me thinks that he does have the ability because he didn't hug Jill. He didn't hug Jill for a very specific reason. He said he was infected. That's the only reason why I think he doesn't, that he does have this ability. However, every single thing else within the show tells me otherwise. Mm-hmm. It tells me otherwise because they were in a desperate situation. After Lori found out that this lady killed herself, she lost the book deal, everything had fallen apart. We got all the people over at the apartment. They're looking for guidance. He's saying that, and he is saying, Mom, we can do all the work that we're doing, and we can strip everything down that they have from the GR, but we're not putting anything back. And he's not like, Ma, I can do this. I can figure this out.
Yeah.
She says, well, let's give them something.
But on the other hand, he said it comes at a price. So maybe he's been afraid to, because maybe it means he is going to die.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think that is requisite. I don't think that is indicative of him having the ability. That's requisite knowledge if you dealt with Wayne at all, because you knew that he was fucked up. You knew that something was happening to him each time he hugged somebody. You saw it. Remember, he was sitting in, he was laying down in the brown underwear.
We
made fun of that scene for a long time.
Yeah. Where do you get it still? I don't know.
So Tom knew. Tom knew that. And he knew everything. And okay, was Tom preparing for this the entire time? I don't know. I mean, they showed that clip of Wayne in the beginning on Tom's computer for a specific reason. And maybe it's to lead you into the idea that he got the idea on how to approach this hugging thing through that video. Mm-hmm. Possible. Totally agree. But I don't think that he has the ability. I don't. I think it was a desperate measure for a desperate time and a desperate need to find something to give these people. But here's the larger issue. I'm confused because Tom then says, well, earlier says, Ma, these GI people, that they know something. Something ain't right here. Yet he's still helping his mother fix these people and potentially lying about this ability. Right?
When he could just be giving hugs.
Well, either he's lying about the ability to give hugs and isn't, and then is withholding it, or he's lying about the ability altogether, all in an effort to help the people move on from the GR.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Like, it's a different choice. It's a different choice that I don't expect from the writers, because it doesn't necessarily line up. It could be indicative of Tom's divided nature and what he wants to believe. But you feel like you have a clear path. You follow that clear path. You have a belief. Let's go along with that belief. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make total sense to me. And the other thing I was a little bit disappointed in is, let's even say this. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, that Wayne did hug Tom. Mm-hmm. And all that stuff did happen, which it would make sense that with the timeline that he gave, because the following day he ends up with Kevin Garvey in the restaurant and dies. It makes sense. But let's just say that he did it. Why would you leave an important scene of that nature to exposition the way that they did? Like, he just sat and talked about it, told a story. I feel like they would show at least a flashback of that happening, right?
No, because they want us to wonder, is he telling the truth?
Yeah, okay. Well, see, again, that's the thing. Do you want to believe it or do you not want to believe it? And if it really did happen, if they really wanted you to believe that it did happen, my idea would be that they would show a flashback. Because clearly, you know, they have no problem showing flashbacks. They did it all throughout the scene with the publisher and the clip that we played at the beginning of the episode. Mm-hmm. You saw the picture of Jill holding the sign, talk, and the fire, and Kevin rescuing Jill, and Lori walking away. Why wouldn't you show it in this scene as
they
well?
They showed it in the previously on The Leftovers.
No. They showed it as it was happening. They didn't show... I'm sorry. I think we're confused.
Yeah.
They showed Wayne give the hugs, But they didn't show Wayne give a hug to Tom.
Yeah, because we're supposed to be wondering.
I know. And what I'm saying is, if the show wanted you to believe, if the show was clear and concise and wanted you to believe, it would have no problem showing you a flashback.
I don't know.
And that's why there's doubt there.
But this show is about doubt versus belief.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So maybe it's their way of saying, you know, what do you believe in? Take that leap of faith.
Oh, great stuff, man. I'm so freaking happy that this show is like this, because it makes for good podcasting. It makes for good conversations. Even if we didn't publish this, I'd be happy to talk about it.
Me too.
Hey, one of the things I actually wanted to talk about too is the Buddha in quotes on Lori's computer. You know, everyone was calling it a Buddha, and it kind of is. But I had an idea that I wanted to look it up. And one of the things that tipped me off about this character on her computer is the hand that's in the palm as it's raising its hand on mm-hmm. the computer. And I started looking it up and I finding different things. And the one thing I could find is that it's not necessarily Buddha itself, is that it's this being within the Buddhist culture called Guan Yin. And Guan Yin is immensely popular among Chinese Buddhists, especially those from devotional schools. She, Guan Yin, is generally seen as a source of unconditional love and, more importantly, as a savior. In her bodhisattva vow, Guan Yin promises to answer the cries and pleas of all sentient beings and to liberate them from their own karmic woes.
You are so deep.
So, listen, is Guan Yin on her computer? I don't know, but the figure and the way that it is, like the actual sticker itself, looks exactly like Guan Yin, and it makes sense that this person, she's taking the GR out of their regular everyday lives. She's taking them out of the samsara, you know, like that wheel that people keep going in and out of. In Buddhism, before they get to nirvana, right? Samsara is the constant evolution of people going, dying, coming back, becoming something, going back and forth. Lori is doing that. And whether or not you want to believe it, maybe she is selfish, but she is still showing unconditional love for the people. She's sacrificing her money. She's sacrificing her car. She's sacrificing her potential freedom. She's doing everything for these people to make sure that they get out of the GR. She's trying to rock them out of it. And that to me seems to make sense. Oh, and one last thing too. Mr. David Burton shows up again. Remember in the newscast that it was happening as Tom was walking in to talk with Lori, there's a newscast happening saying that there's a guy in Australia said that he died and has come back and is unable to die again. Unable to die again. And guess who that guy is? David Burton. That is also the same guy that...
42 Willoughby Way, Sydney? That Dirty Santa?
That Dirty Santa... is writing to.
How does Dirty Santa know about this guy if he's stuck on his Dirty Santa tower?
Couldn't tell you. Reindeer. Maybe he's got a radio up there.
Or a reindeer. Radio.
And more importantly, we have Kevin Garvey Sr. going to Australia because he's heard these voices. Now, you cannot tell me that David Burton, the voices, and Dirty Santa aren't connected.
Oh, obviously they are.
They are. So it's more Australia references, again, going back to Lost.
We have to go back, Kate.
I love what they're doing with Australia, this Australia thing, because it's bringing you to a whole nother, what the hell is happening over there? And that's all I got, kid.
Sounds good.
What do you think we do some listener feedback? So the first one we got is an email from, oh my God, I'm going to go with this, and someone is probably not going to be very happy with me, but Zaria Cabellos, so please forgive me, She says, I don't know how much of Tom's story is true, but if Wayne, in fact, went to see him, it gives me this theory. I think that perhaps Wayne didn't actually grant Kevin's wish. He just knew it was going to happen. Like he tells Tom what to do with the baby, and next day he finds Kevin and tells him to make a wish. Maybe he just threw his daughter, was going to end up with him, and that Kevin needed a family. So that wasn't magic, but it was random and unexplicable. Maybe there was a logical explanation after all. And maybe there's a logical explanation for everything happening on the show, but they're just showing it in bits or not showing it at all. And I don't care about the departure, why it happened or where they went, if it's going to happen again, but maybe they're trying to tell us that there is a logical explanation. They just don't tell us which it is.
Our friends on Facebook, Brandy Botzel, says, I've always been interested in Lori and Tom. They just seem so wounded. With Lori, I realized that I've been waiting for her to finally snap. Somebody eventually needs to know about the baby. There would have to be some accounting for why she left, though the people that loved her still haven't gotten that. As for Tom, he seemed always to be doing the right thing and never, ever seemed to be rewarded for it. So I fear that this new act will end up being bad for both Lori and Tom. Maybe it's a mother-son connection that resonates very strongly with me and my own son. I identify more with that.
I wanted to ask you about this. Do you agree with Brandy about the identification with the mother and the son? And do you identify with them more because you have a relationship with your son?
No.
No.
I identify with her more because I went through depression.
Gotcha. So,
oh my God. Wait, stop. I got to stop the feedback for a second.
Yes, what?
Okay, when she's having whiplash time and she's in the cafe and she's writing, she looks over and she sees a mother and a daughter.
Mm.
And I thought, God, not only does it suck because she misses Jill, but that daughter seemed to be so young. And what if the baby she lost was about that age, like 4 years old?
Yes. Oh my God, that's 100% right.
Because I was taking the Whiplash music as Crazy Town music.
Yep.
And I was like, she's typing away and she looks over and there's, oh, you used to maybe be able to hang out with Jill and, you know, take her to a little cafe.
Yep.
Or maybe would that have been you right now if you hadn't, if your baby hadn't departed. Anyway, go back to listener feedback, but I forgot to mention that.
Maybe it's because she is so angry. She's angry that she lost that baby, even though she probably didn't want it. Now she is. She's angry now. And that's why I think the people could tell that.
She's lost her other daughter. So she's like, she's lost two kids.
She's lost everything, almost. Mike Cardenas says, the fact that this scene followed his mom saying, we need to give them something, makes me think that it's a put on.
Melanie Lynn, do you think Meg was trying to get pregnant with Tommy Garvey's baby so she can tether Lori forever to the guilty remnant?
Ooh, good one.
Interesting.
That's some good vindictive stuff right there. That's Patty-esque. Russell McVicker says, okay, we know now that Lori was washing her car in the beginning because she has a thing for running down GR, and she was shocked there was still blood on the windshield while waiting for Tommy. But could this also mean that she may be superficially washing the GR from herself?
Hmm.
But deep down, she still belongs to them. Great stuff, Russell. I love where you're going with this. Steve Blaze says, anyone get the same impression as me from that book publisher that it was Damon Lindelof's critique of critics' critiques of the show so far? Yeah, it's heartbreaking, but it doesn't make me feel anything. What am I supposed to feel? F you! How do you think you're supposed to feel? LOL.
On Twitter, GC93. The Leftover Season 2 is why you should always give a second chance to shows with amazing potential. Jennifer Lee tweets, whoa, I did not expect The Guilty Remnant to be so brutal. What happened to silently taunting people?
I'm going to hold off on that one.
Natalie Ramirez says, extremely aggressive amount of full frontal.
Okay, before we move on, do you agree with that? Do you think the full frontal is necessary? And are you okay with it?
I'm okay with it.
Yeah. All right. Calm down.
I'm okay with it.
No, no. It. You think it was okay with, in terms of the story, it was necessary for the story?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, because it shows you the brutal nature that Meg really handled this kid with, right?
She did not dry hump him.
No, she did not.
That's what the nudity showed me.
Mm-hmm.
She did not rub. Cat Caps tweeted, it's not funny.
Sorry.
I'm sorry if I used a funny word.
No, no, no.
It's not funny.
Oh, that's just... It's just how it came out.
I know. Sorry. And if any of you laughed, I'm sorry. I didn't mean. I'm just trying to clarify. Cat Caps says, my mind was blown with that last episode. What a masterpiece these first three episodes are, if you see them as a trilogy.
Oh, yes, because they all go hand in hand. They all take part in the same time frame that you were talking about the same way. You ready for the voicemails?
Yes.
All right, let's do it.
Hello, Mary and Blake. This is Rafe Collins. The third episode was awesome. Absolutely just fire, and there's so much to deal with. What I'd like to talk about is what I think in watching The Leftovers, we're dealing with not only how the characters would cope with a departure, but how we ourselves would cope with an event like that. And I guess for some people, a departure would strengthen their belief in the supernatural. For some people, the departure would weaken their belief in the supernatural. We've talked on the Facebook page for The Leftovers about a perfectly natural explanation for the departure. But for me, I have this feeling that all bets are off. And I said this more than once on Facebook. I just don't, like, I can't deal with anybody saying to me, or I wouldn't be able to deal with it, with somebody saying, oh, that could never happen. That's scientifically impossible. Well, the disappearance of 2% of the world is supposed to be scientifically impossible. But in The Leftovers, we're living on a planet where it happened. So, you know, that brings me to my next point about belief and religion, which I think is being brilliantly examined in The Leftovers. Like, what is it about the idea that Holy Wayne could actually have powers, or that Tom could actually have powers that pushes people over the edge? And I don't mean like in an angry way. I mean, it's almost like they don't have any more space to believe anything incredible. Like it's like there isn't room, with the departure taking up so much space and oxygen, there isn't room for anything else. You know, like, why is the idea that Holy Wayne could actually have some power, and that Tom could actually have some power, far-fetched?
Rafe, thanks for calling in. You bring up some very good points. Is it far-fetched? You know, in this world that we're in today, our current world, it's hard for people to accept this idea. But within the context of The Leftovers, when there are cults forming and there are things happening and there are things that are inexplicable, it is inexplicable for 2% of the world's population to disappear. There is no real science behind it. It's just simply, as Mary said earlier, a leap of faith. It is something that you choose to believe. And if you choose to believe it, then you can. And that is what the show asks you to do as a viewer. It asks you, do you want to engage with me? Do you think that Tom or Wayne has this ability? Because if you do, great. If you don't, even better. Just explain to yourself why. And then you can go forward from there. That's the idea behind it. So what do you believe? You think it's not that hard to accept? Great, move on with that. You don't necessarily, just because somebody doesn't agree with that, doesn't mean that you're wrong or you're right. It's all just faith, and the show begs you to go forward with that. For me personally, I think Wayne probably had something. I do. I wonder about Tommy. I don't think that he does, but I think Wayne did, because I think that he had something. Whether or not it was true, or whether or not it actually worked for people, I don't know, but it was at least a Band-Aid. It was at least a placebo. At least worked for them because that made them feel better. It gave them a sense of purpose. It gave them a chance to belong to something. just like how Tommy and Lori wanted that to happen again. They had a chance to belong. They had a chance to move on. They had a chance to belong with the people that didn't feel badly anymore. And that's what I think that the idea is.
Hi, Mary and Blake. This is Katie. I am from Newport Beach, California. First time calling in, but I have been listening to you guys for a while now. I started with the Outlander podcast, which I love. Thank you guys so much for just making the whole experience so much fun. I look forward, I think, to the podcast just as much, if not maybe more, to the show. So I just feel like you're part of the family. Love it. And when I saw you guys did the Leftovers podcast, I was equally as excited because that show has been awesome. I love what they're doing with the show. I wanted to start off by just making a comment about episode 2 and when Nora and Kevin were in the adoption agency. Actually, my husband, he had an interesting theory as to why the adoption agent showed them the picture of the white baby. He was like, maybe he's just doing it just to test them to make sure that they really did want their baby. So I thought that that was interesting. Also, I love the way that they are kind of revealing new characters, starting episode 1 with the new ones that we didn't know at all, and then episode 2 kind of straddling back from season 1 into Miracle, you know, introducing new things, and then episode 3 going straight back with Lori. And I just love the way they're doing it because it totally builds tension better. So exciting. With episode 3, I really love the way that they continued with the music for Lori, kind of the same way paralleling with Kevin, and I just thought that was awesome. And I'm loving it, loving you guys. You're great. Keep it up. And I just can't wait to see where all these characters kind of cross paths moving forward. So, all right, you guys. Thank you. Bye.
Katie, thank you so much for calling in. And as you know, we do have a new listener sound that we always play, and this is it. Just adds another coin in the bank for us. Thank you so much. And even though you do listen to our Outlander podcast, you are new to the Leftovers podcast. So thank you so much for listening. Excellent theory from your husband about why they proposed this other baby to Nora and Kevin. Is it because they just wanted to test him? I don't know. Again, it's a matter of faith and something that you want to accept. Is it just because they have this abundance of babies? Who knows? Whatever. Maybe he thought that Nora and Kevin looked like good people and they just wanted to help out. I don't know. But excellent. And thank you so much for listening. And thank you for so much for the kind words. I'm honored. And I know Mary is honored that you listen to us each week. And we look forward to not only the show, but speaking with you guys about this show. That's what's most important to us. So again, Katie, thank you so much.
Hi, this is Carrie from Massachusetts. And I really enjoyed the episode, but I would have to give it 4 Damons. Didn't enjoy it as much as the first 2 episodes. It was nice to get to see Lori talking and out of her crazy cult. As I started watching the show, I was thinking about how all of last season, I really wanted to know more about the guilty remnant and what they believed and why the hell they chain smoked. And all of that was really interesting to me. But at this point in the season, I was kind of wishing that I just got to go back to see more of Miracle. And that kind of goes to show what an amazing show this really is. I love seeing the little things about the post-departure life, such as the office with the people working for the departure insurance. Don't leave your life to chance. I love things like that. And when Lori was telling her story in the group, I got really excited, thinking that I was finally going to hear her story and more about the beliefs of the crazy cult. And then she went from, I had Patty as a patient and something terrible was going to happen, and I was lonely, and then next thing I know, I was screaming my daughter's name and thought I killed her. Damn it.
Katie, thank you so much for calling. You know, you made a great point, actually, about this sudden departure insurance thing. wow. I mean, they've really fleshed out this entire world. And Mary and I, we forgot to talk about it, so I apologize. But they've really fleshed out this world and the things that are happening within it for the viewers. I mean, they're talking about insurance for future departures, right? How crazy is that? Hey, spend $100 extra and your family will be taken care of. It's almost like life insurance almost, but it's departure insurance. It's crazy. I wonder what the premiums would be for that. And like, how do they actually go? Like, do you have to take medical tests? And like, what? I don't know. Whatever. Sorry, I'm just going off on a tangent. But regardless, what I'm getting at is they're fleshing out the world. And it's a big, big world building episode for this world. And the other part of me thinks that, you know, that building was kind of shady. And the things that are going on in that building are shady. So it makes me wonder if the departure insurance is a scam. Yeah, give me the $100 and whatever. We'll pay you off your family. But how would you ever know? You just keep paying premiums, and people are making money off of this departure. Again, it goes back to this consumerism thing that I brought up earlier in the episode, and it goes back to previous episodes where people are making so much money off this departure, namely Miracle being one of them, probably the chief among them. They keep going back to the idea of the loved ones and Miracle, and now the departure insurance, really, really, really cool stuff, and how much money actually plays into this. Carrie, thank you so much for bringing this up. And yes, I was frustrated when we didn't get Lori's full story, but I've got a feeling that's one of those things, again, the leap of faith that we're going to have to take. Either the baby disappeared or it didn't. And my belief is that it did. And that's what drove her out of Kevin's hands, arms, and into the GRs and Patty's.
Hey, fellow lefties. This is Missy, editor of the Living Reminders blog. Well, we had lots of GR action going on in this episode, don't you think? First, I want to send out a shout-out to Heather Kafka, who portrays Susan, the member of the Guilty Remnant. What an incredible story for this brilliant actress, huh? I can't stop rewatching the scene with the semi-truck and she killed her whole family. By the way, I thought was perfectly synced with Max Richter's departure melody. What an awesome departure moment. Also, let's not forget how Lori rocked this episode. She's running over GRs like a badass. So, I mean, I know that wasn't cool, but I thought it was. Once again, we hear the Pixies, only this time in a classical rendition of Where's My Mind. And I'm glad they followed the previous episode with that. It let us stay connected, especially with how their character jumping and all. So, next, I have a question for the Easter egg spotters out there. Remember in season one, Kevin loses his bagel in the toaster oven? And in this episode, Lori's landlord, Victor, snatches a bagel from Lori. What the hell's going on here? What is it with the bagels? I know I'm reaching, but I even asked Jasmine Brown, who plays the lovely Evie, about the bagels on Twitter, and she responded, right? What I would really like to know is what kind it was. So the cast is really cool with interacting with their fans, guys. And for those of you who would like a nod, I definitely suggest following the cast of the show because they're awesome. So Holy Wayne is back. Well, not entirely back, but we did get a few answers as to what happened between him and Tom. So we have Holy Tommy now offering free warm hugs. That's going to be interesting throughout the rest of the season, I think. So overall, another great episode, and I can't wait until next Sunday. For those of you listening out there and want more of the Leftovers action, be sure to stop by and check out the Living Reminders blog at thelivingremindersblog.blogspot.com. We have a great writing team dishing out articles, excellent articles about the Leftovers. If you're a Leftovers fan, you've got to check it out. Until we meet again, thanks everyone.
This why is why, ladies and gentlemen, Missy absolutely rules. She does the job for me. She is fantastic. She plugs. She gives the shameless plug for us. Thank you so much, Missy. You absolutely rock. And I love what you brought up about the bagels, and I love what you brought up about Holy Wayne. Now, okay, is Holy Wayne back? No. But there's been a theory out there that Holy Wayne is David Burton. That would blow my mind. If Holy Wayne is actually David Burton, just under a different name, I would freak the fuck out. It would be crazy. It would be insane. So I'll leave it at that. But yeah, again, guys, please check out the Living Reminders blog. It's at thelivingreminders.com. Just hit
the little blog button, and you'll be able to read it there.
All right, everybody, thank you so much for those phone calls. We love it. And make sure next time you call, it's 503-454-6730. But now, my darling, it is time for the Brian David's Thought of the Week.
Mary and Blake, it's Brian Davids again from the Film Schlubs podcast. This episode was beautifully insane. I like how the show has quickly reminded people that they're not abandoning the most polarizing aspect of season one. That is, of course, the guilty remnant. Some of us feared a reboot this season, and so far, the title sequence is the only major reboot. Anyway, the casting of the secondary characters in this episode was impeccable, including the sleazy landlord, the insensitive book publisher, and of course Susan, the ex-GR who returns home with Lori's help. Interesting to note, Susan is played by actress Heather Kafka. The term Kafka-esque is marked by surreal distortion and often a sense of impending danger. The moment I saw Susan's face, I had a feeling something tragic would happen by episode's end. When the landlord bit into that bagel, it sent shivers down my spine. The way the book publisher struggled for Jill's name was something so subtle, yet maddening if you're inside Lori's head. What I ultimately took away from this episode is that there is a battle in the works for Tommy Garvey between Meg and Lori. Obviously, Lori doesn't know the extent of what Meg did to him, but the mere fact she raped him suggests that she's trying to seduce him away from his mother. That is the best revenge the GR could take out on Lori. Meg's seduction could lead Tommy to join the GR, especially since he yelled to Lori, "They make sense. They know something." He's shown visible frustration with what he's doing with Lori. "It's not working," he added. So that prompted Tom and Lori to come up with the fraudulent Holy Wayne routine. After all, Tommy was shown looking at the Holy Wayne video on YouTube so he could kind of study his pitch. What if Meg becomes pregnant with Tommy's baby? That goes against the GR as we know them, given the lack of quiet a baby would cause their solidarity. But is Meg introducing her own brand of GR? After all, I don't recall sex being a part of their lives, since sex reproduces life. And that would contradict their mindset that the world has ended. Anyway, once Tommy's Holy Wayne act is exposed as fraudulent and Meg seduces him even more, I think Tommy will join the GR. And how ironic would that be? Lori once left her family for the GR, and now they've all left her. Thank you again to Mary and Blake, and you, the audience, for listening. You can find me, Brian Davids, on Twitter at BDF331, as well as Film Schlubs, and of course, the Living Reminders blog. Prior to episode 3, I published my random takes, theories, and observations following episode 2.
Brian, thank you so much. As always, we love every time that you call in, and you always, my friend, bring it every single time. Now, it is time for the tweet of the week. You ready, kiddo?
Yep.
This week's tweet of the week is from Bates Motel 66. Remember Kevin Sr. first uses the word give, but the voices demand that he use the word accept. And I believe Tommy's story because he used the word accept as well.
Oh my gosh.
So I totally understand this. And that's why I picked this as a tweet. It's not necessarily funny, but it is perfect for this story because here's the thing. Acceptance has been a major part of everything in The Leftovers, especially this particular episode. When Lori asked people to come to her little group, she said, "Would you like to join us?" They had to accept her invitation. Tommy has to accept his ability if he potentially has it or doesn't have it. Kevin has to accept, both the Kevins have to accept the voices and what they're telling them and what their mission potentially from those voices are. It's all about acceptance. Very, very, very good stuff. And so congratulations, Bates Motel 66. You are this week's tweet of the week. And just as a reminder, you actually won a $20 gift card to the Tag Your It Etsy shop for winning this Tweet of the Week. So that's that. So make sure you go to Tag Your It Etsy shop online and redeem your $20 gift card. My love, it is now time for the sudden theory of the week. What do you got? Did you hold any theories back this week?
I never do. I let them flow. Let it go.
You ready? You ready for my sudden theory of the week? Again, you're just breaking out into let it go. Just you know, let it roll. Go ahead.
No, I'm not going to.
You're not
going to
let it roll?
No.
Oh, okay. Here's my sudden theory of the week. Meg shows up and totally dominates Tommy, right? Just obliterates the kid because she could. And you could tell that she has this very specific kind of power. And what tipped me off to this sudden theory of the week is actually from one of the listeners when they said, hey, what happened to the guilty remnant? And they're just silently stalking people. You could tell at the end of season one that Meg was like legit. And she was not messing around anymore. She had no problem making people remember what happened on Memorial Day. And in fact, I think she enjoyed what happened on Memorial Day. With that said, I think she has created a new branch of the GR. One that is like muscle.
It's angry. It's the angry GR. Not yes. just the sad and
like
depressed.
The world has ended. Oh, I hate my life. It's no. The world has ended. And not only are we just going to stalk you and remind you, we're going to tell you.
It's almost like we're mad at you because you forgot.
Yeah, and we're going to force it on you, and I'm going to impose my will on you. And you could tell that she it's like the left or the right. You know, it's the left, you have the Democrats, and you have like the Democrats that are like way, way left. They're almost socialist, right? And then you have the Republicans. And then you have the Republicans that are way, way right. They're like fascists almost, right? They're like neo-Nazis. I'm thinking that Meg is the neo-Nazi of the GR. And she has created this wing of the GR, maybe based out of Mapleton, I don't know. But they found success in doing things the way they did. They found success in the loved ones and getting beat up and the houses getting burned down. Yeah, maybe the house got burned down and maybe the Mapleton Hive got obliterated. But guess what? People remember. And it's a big time deal. And I think that she's created this wing. And more importantly, here's another theory for you. Tom is going into that wing.
Even though he's now Huggy?
He's now Huggy, doesn't matter. I guarantee you, you can put a bet on it. Just like how last year I called Jill going into the GR. Tom is going to join Meg in this wing of the GR. And that is that.
Please hang up and try again.
My love, what are your final thoughts for this episode? You got anything?
I got it all out.
Wow, look at you.
It doesn't help that I'm juggling a baby right now. And no. So my brain is officially done. I got her to stop screaming. That's my job.
A couple of things that I did want to share. We actually talked about Whiplash throughout this episode. Whiplash, as a matter of fact, is directed by a Providence native. His name is Damien Chazelle. So if you please go watch this movie, Whiplash, it's really good. Miles Teller, J.K. Simmons. As a matter of fact, J.K. Simmons won an Oscar for it, and it's directed by a Providence native. So we're from Providence. I got to give this guy some credit. It was really good. The use of the music in this show continues to grow at exponential levels. Not only is it Max Richter's work, but it's the choices that Lindelof and the writers make and the directors make with all the musical choices within the show. For example, Where Is My Mind by the Pixies playing again in this episode, but it was a piano version of the real version throughout the episode, right? And it connects Lori and Kevin. It connects them, even though they're thousands and thousands of miles away apart from each other, they're still connected to each other in the situation that is happening. And the last thing I wanted to share was that there was this really cool tweet from ESPN NFL where the Leftovers actress, Ann Dowd, she is a Massachusetts girl, so that a girl, if you get a chance, go back to listen to our interview with Ann Dowd on thelivingreminders.com, shameless plug. She found inspiration from her character from an unexpected source, Bill Belichick. the head coach of the New England Patriots. And if you go to at ESPN NFL, it has the whole video of how they interviewed her and how she took inspiration from him and what she did and the myth that is Bill Belichick, not the man, but the myth that he's this quiet, menacing dude, and she made her character look like him in that myth. Really, really cool stuff. So that's what I wanted to share. You ready to close out the show, kiddo?
Yes.
All right. Since you don't have any more final thoughts, you got it all out. Well, that is it, ladies and gentlemen. That is the end of our show. If you want to continue the conversation, you can reach us at any time on any of our social media handles, whether it's Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, what smoke signals, I don't know, whatever you could think of, you can reach us. It's all at Living Reminders. And if the social media isn't enough for you, you can always reach us at livingreminders@gmail.com. Check out all of our great web... all of our... I totally messed this up. Check out all of our great interviews and other episodes all at thelivingreminders.com, where you can find all the great interviews with all the cast, crew, and everything. It's all there, and we're there to help. While you're there, also check out this support button for The Living Reminders. In the support button, there's a bunch of different ways you can actually support us, which is through PayPal, or if you want to donate a dollar or $2 or $125 billion each month, you can do that, and we would gladly accept it through Patreon.com. But the most important way you can support us is tell a friend. If what we do here actually provides value for you, and what you and you like it and you really enjoy it, tell a friend that we exist. Tell a friend that The Leftovers exists. And let them know that this show freaking rocks and our podcast freaking rocks. That would be the most and best important thing you can do for our free podcast. In the meantime, you can also go to iTunes and give us a rating and a review. Whatever you think we deserve, it's a 1 or hopefully a 5 or a 4 or whatever you think we deserve, please give that to us. And we would gladly appreciate and gladly take that. I think that's it. I think that's the whole spiel that I got for you. Oh, go to the Living Reminders blog. Just go to thelivingreminders.com. Again, I'm going to plug this shamelessly. And just hit the blog button. You'll find all the great articles there. And written by the fans, for the fans, just for you guys. So if you can't get enough of us, go to the blog. Or, hey, even better yet, go to the other podcasts. The ones that we always recommend are Jay and Jack and the Guilty Remnant podcasts. Those guys are very smart. They know what they're talking about. They're much smarter than us. And if you can't get enough of The Leftovers, that's that. But for Mary Larson, my name is Blake, and we'll see you later.